This is Audible.
Tim Ferriss presents What I Learned Losing $1 Million, written by Jim Paul and Brendan Moynihan, narrated by Patrick Lawler. Foreword, Jack Schwager. One paradox I often pose to my audiences in talks about the elements of successful trading concerns the dichotomy in human thinking as it relates to trading versus everything else. Specifically, I use the following example. No sane person would walk into a bookstore, assuming you could still find one these days, go to the medical section, find a book on brain surgery, read it over the weekend, and then believe he could walk into an operating room on Monday morning and perform successful brain surgery. The operative word here is sane. Yet how many people do you know who would think that it is perfectly reasonable to walk into a bookstore, go to the investment section, find a book with a title like How I Made $1 Million Trading Stocks Last Year, read it over the weekend, and then start trading Monday morning and expect to beat the professionals at their own game? Why this dichotomy in thinking? The foregoing paradox is one that I believe has a satisfactory answer. Trading, as far as I know, is the only endeavor in which the rank amateur has a 50-50 chance of being right. Why? Because there are only two things you could do in trading. You can buy, or you can sell. And, as a consequence, some portion of clueless beginners will get it right simply by chance. For a while. This potential for temporary success by pure luck beguiles people into thinking that trading is a lot easier than it is. The potential for even temporary success doesn't exist in any other profession. If you have never trained as a surgeon, the probability of your performing successful brain surgery is zero. If you have never picked up a violin, your chances of playing successful solo violin in front of the New York Philharmonic are zero. It is just that trading has this quirk that allows some people to be successful temporarily without true skill or an edge. And that fools people into mistaking luck for skill. Jim Paul thought that his early success in the markets was caused by his being smart, or maybe by his willingness to break the rules. He didn't realize that his heady run was based on luck until he had lost all his profits and a good deal more. And Paul would be the first to admit that his winning streak was a matter of luck, even though it lasted for years. This conclusion is unavoidable because his deficiency as a trader made a total loss inevitable. As he readily acknowledges, even if he had not lost all his money when he did, it would merely have postponed this ultimate outcome, perhaps to a point in time when his loss would have been that much greater. The truth is that trading, both successful and unsuccessful, is more about psychology than tactics. As Jim Paul ultimately learns through a very expensive lesson taught by the market, successful trading is not about discovering a great strategy for making money, but rather a matter of learning how to lose. From the research he conducts following his catastrophic experience in the markets, Paul realizes that winning traders differ radically, using approaches that often contradict one another. What winning traders share, however, is that they all understand that losing is part of the game, and they all have learned how to lose. By losing everything, Paul becomes an expert on losing, and it is only then that he can become a winning trader rather than a temporarily lucky one. There is more to be learned from Jim Paul's true story of failure than from a stack of books promising to reveal the secret formula for success. Not only that, What I Learned Losing $1 Million is a much more entertaining read. Although the book can be read simply as a humorous and breezy tale, listeners should not lose sight of the fact that this compact volume is filled with a wealth of trading wisdom and insights. It cost Paul a fortune to learn these lessons. The listener has the opportunity to benefit from this knowledge for the mere cost of a book. A true bargain. Preface to the Columbia Edition. Since this book was first published nearly 20 years ago, a lot has changed in the world of trading. Open outcry is nearly dead, exchanges have merged, and newfangled instruments have been created, some of which generated losses that brought the global financial market to its knees. One thing that has not changed over the past 20 years is the decision-making mistakes that traders and investors make in the markets. Whether you are a professional managing other people's money or an individual managing your own money, you are susceptible to these mistakes, if not on the same scale of operations. Since the book's first printing, we have witnessed some colossal risk management disasters. For example, Nick Leeson of Barings Bank lost £827 million, $1.4 billion in 1995, betting on the Japanese stock market. Toshihide Iguchi of Daiwa Bank lost $1.1 billion the same year. Yasuo Hamanaka, a.k.a. Mr. Copper of Sumitomo, lost $2.6 billion trading copper in 1996. Then there was John Rusnak at Allfirst Bank, who lost $691 million in 2002 trading currencies. Chenju Lin of China Aviation Oil Corporation lost $550 million in 2005 trading jet fuel futures. It was a spectacular fall from grace for the king of aviation oil. And Jerome Curviel of Société Générale dropped a stunning 4.9 billion euros, $7.4 billion, between 2006 and 2008 in equity derivatives. These highly publicized cases and others riveted media, management, and academic attention on the strategies and controls of the risk management business. While the many postmortems offered valuable lessons, mostly in the areas of internal controls and hedge strategy selection, these autopsies have largely overlooked what went on inside the minds of the individual traders actually pulling the trigger on the trades. While lax controls may have enabled these losses to occur, and questionable hedging strategies may have contributed to the losses, neither factor caused the losses. Traders did. And to understand and prevent losses, we need to get inside the mind of the individual. This book does that. I use Jim Paul's story as a parable to point out the three biggest mistakes that investors and traders make every day in the markets. These have not changed and never will. The mistakes are timeless, and so are the lessons for avoiding them. I've talked to hundreds of traders and investors since the book's publication, and to a person they've agreed with the premise of the book and the lessons it holds. This is because all of us lose money at some point, and the book simply identifies the mental processes, behavioral characteristics, and emotions that lead us into those losses. Then it offers a prescription for avoiding those processes, characteristics, and emotions, and the losses that accompany them. May the lessons teach and the stories entertain. Preface. Books can generally be categorized into one of three groups: education, entertainment, or reference. Education books teach us, entertainment books amuse us, and reference books inform us. This book combines education with entertainment to make it easier to recall the lessons by remembering the story. In that sense, this book is a parable. A simple story illustrating important lessons. From the story of the little boy who cried wolf to the story of the emperor's new clothes, parables have been used to convey lessons that apply to many aspects of life. Similarly, in this book, the story is about a commodities trader, but its lessons apply to stock market and bond market investors, as well as all types of business people, entrepreneurs, managers, and CEOs. The moral of the story you are about to hear is, success can be built upon repeated failures when the failures aren't taken personally. Likewise, failure can be built upon repeated successes when the successes are taken personally. Thomas Edison failed roughly 10,000 times before finding the right filament to make an electric light bulb. The day his Menlo Park laboratory burned to the ground, a reporter asked him what he was going to do. Edison responded, "Start rebuilding tomorrow." In part, Edison succeeded because he didn't take failures or losses personally. On the other hand, consider Henry Ford, who worked with and greatly admired Edison. Ford started in 1905 with nothing, and in 15 years had built the largest and most profitable manufacturing firm on the planet. Yet a few years later, this seemingly impregnable business empire was in shambles and would go on to lose money almost every year for the next two decades. Ford was known to stick uncompromisingly to his opinions. Is it possible his company lost so much money because he took the successes personally and came to think he could do no wrong? Personalizing successes sets people up for disastrous failure. They begin to treat the successes totally as a personal reflection of their abilities rather than the result of capitalizing on a good opportunity, being at the right place at the right time, or even being just plain lucky. They think their mere involvement in an undertaking guarantees success. This phenomenon has been called many things: hubris, overconfidence, arrogance. But the way in which successes become personalized and the processes that precipitate the subsequent failure have never been clearly spelled out. That is what we have set out to do. This book is a case study of the classic tale of countless entrepreneurs, the risk taker who sees an opportunity, the idea that clicks, the intoxicating growth, the errors, and the collapse. Our case is that of a trader. But as with all case studies and parables, the lessons can be applied to a great many other situations. These lessons will help you whether you are in the markets or in business. The two areas have more in common than one might suppose. Warren Buffett, the richest man in America, is quoted on the cover of Forbes' 1993 edition of The 400 Richest People in America. "I am a better investor because I am a businessman. And I'm a better businessman because I'm an investor." If the elements of success can be transferred between the markets and business, the elements of failure can, too. We could study a hypothetical series of successes to demonstrate how success becomes personalized and then how a loss follows. But you are more likely to remember and learn the lessons if they are presented in anecdotes about a real person and a really big loss. How big? The collapse of a 15-year career and the loss of over $1 million in a mere 75 days. Why a book on losing? Almost without exception, anyone who has participated in markets has made some money. Apparently, people have at least some knowledge about making money in the markets. However, since most people have lost more money than they have made, it is equally apparent that they lack knowledge about not losing money. When they do lose, they buy books and attend seminars in search of a new method of how to make money, since the last method was obviously defective. They are like racing fans making the same losing bet on an instant replay. Investors' bookshelves are filled with Horatio Alger stories of rags-to-riches millionaires. Sometimes these books are read solely for entertainment, but more often than not, they are read in an attempt to learn the secret of how the millionaires made their fortunes, particularly when those millions were made by trading in the markets. Most of these books are of the how-to genre, from James Brisbane's 1881 classic, The Beef Bonanza, How to Get Rich on the Plains, to modern-day versions of How to Get Rich in the Market, How to Win in the Market, How to Use What You Already Know to Make, how to apply the winning strategies, how to make $1 million in the market before breakfast. We've all read them. But if the how-to books were that beneficial, we'd all be rich. A review of the investment and trading literature reveals very little written about losing money. When something has been written on this topic, it's usually a sensationalistic, unauthorized tell-all biography or tabloid-like exposé that panders to people who delight in the misfortune of others. Personality journalism books are definitely read for entertainment, not as an attempt to learn from the subject's mistakes. Losing has received only superficial coverage in most books on the markets. They raise the subject, stress its importance, and then leave it dangling. What I Learned Losing $1 Million is a light treatise on the psychology of losing and is intended for investors, speculators, traders, brokers, and money managers who have either lost money or would like to protect against losing what they've made. Most discussions of the psychological aspects of the markets focus on behavioral psychology or psychoanalysis, that is, sublimation, regression, suppression, anger, self-punishment. This isn't to say such books aren't instructive. It's just that most people find it hard to digest and apply the information presented in those books. Other books use hypothetical character sketches to make their points, while others simply compile a list of old saws about losses. This book, on the other hand, entertains and educates you on the psychology of market losses in layman's terms, anecdotally, through the story of a trader who actually lost over $1 million in the market. The first part of the book is Jim Paul's personal odyssey of an unbroken string of successes that took him from dirt-poor country boy to jet-setting millionaire and member of the executive committee at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, before a devastating $1.6 million loss brought him crashing down. One of the premises of this book is that the rise sets up the fall. The winning sets up the losing. You can't really be set up for disaster without having it preceded by success. If you go into a situation in a neutral position, having neither successes nor failures beforehand, you acknowledge that your odds are maybe 50-50. You may have a winner, you may have a loser. But if you start from scratch and have a run of successes, you are setting yourself up for the coming failure because the successes lead to a variety of psychological distortions. This is particularly true if you have unknowingly broken the rules of the game and won anyway. Once that happens to you, you think that you are somehow special and exempt from following the rules. The seeds of Jim's disaster were sown with his first job at the age of 9. His exposure to the outside world, money and material things, was the foundation for his career's sharp and quick ascent, as well as its ultimate collapse. Repeated attempts to make the money back by speculating in the markets ended in failure and left Jim disillusioned. He set out on a quest to find out how the pros made money in the markets so he could follow their example. When you're sick, you want to consult the best doctors. When you're in trouble, you want the best lawyers. So Jim read all about the techniques of the professionals to learn their secret of making money. But this search left him even more disillusioned, since he discovered that the masters made money not only in widely varying ways, but also in ways that contradicted each other. What one market pro advocated, another ardently opposed. It finally occurred to him that studying losses, losing, and how not to lose was more important than studying how to make money. The second part of the book presents the lessons Jim learned from his losing experience. Namely, there are as many ways to make money in the markets as there are people participating in the markets, but there are relatively few ways to lose money in the markets. People lose money in the markets either because of errors in their analysis or because of psychological factors that prevent the application of the analysis. Most of the losses are due to the latter. All analytical methods have some validity and make allowances for the times when they won't work. but psychological factors can keep you in a losing position and also cause you to abandon one method for another when the first one produces a losing position. The third part of the book shows you how to avoid the losses due to psychological factors. Trading and investment mistakes are well known and easily understood, but difficult to correct. What you need is not a long litany of complex psychological theories, but a simple framework to help you understand, accept, and thereby avoid catastrophic losses. This book will help you recognize, identify, and avoid the pitfalls of investing, trading, and speculating. So, why a book on losing? Because there are as many ways to make money in the markets as there are participants, but relatively few ways to lose. And despite all the books on how to make money in the markets, most of us aren't rich. Brendan Moynihan, Nashville, Tennessee, May 1994. Part 1. Reminiscences of a Trader. Experience is the worst teacher. It gives the test before giving the lesson. Unknown. I made $248,000. In one day, $250,000. The high was unbelievable. It's literally like you expect God to call up any minute and ask if it's okay to let the sun come up tomorrow morning. I had a special desk that was a copper pedestal coming out from the floor, and on top of it was a giant 3-foot by 6-foot by 7-inch piece of mahogany. The tabletop looked like it was suspended in midair. The credenza was a matching piece of wood bolted to the wall, also looking like it was suspended in midair. When you walked into the office, all you could see was carpet stretching out in front of you, a copper column rising up from the carpet, and two pieces of wood levitating in midair, defying gravity. And that is just what I thought I was doing, defying gravity. I sat down at my desk on the edge of my chair, waiting for the market to open, ready to have another $50,000 day, and thinking life didn't get any better than this. I was right. It didn't. The market opened down that morning and never traded higher than it did on that last Friday in August. It started down that Monday, and I proceeded to lose, on average, about $20,000 to $25,000 a day, every day, for months. The decline was relentless, with only occasional spasms to the upside. Fortunately, I started getting the clients out of the market. Most of the clients got out with some profit, some with small losses. Naturally, I didn't get out. I was in for the long pull. This was going to be the big trade. Kirby and I were going to make $10 million on this trade. By the middle of October, I was underwater. I didn't know how far under I was, but I knew I'd lost most of my money. As the position got increasingly worse, I began to get margin calls. I'd wait a few days to see if the market rallied so I wouldn't have to meet the margin call. If it did, fine. If it didn't, I'd spend the next couple of days trying to borrow money from my friends. I'd be on margin call for 2 or 3 days at a time, but the brokerage firm's attitude was, "We know you're a big wheel. You're on the board of governors of the exchange. You're on the executive committee. You're an officer of your firm, etc. We know you're good for the money." The first week in November, I was underwater big time, $200,000 or $300,000. I didn't even know how much it was. Bean oil had gone from 36 or 37 cents a pound down to 25 cents. So from the high in August, I was down $700,000 or $800,000. To make matters worse, I'd borrowed about $400,000 from my friends. The firm finally and mercifully pulled the plug on me because I couldn't. On November 17th, one of the senior managers from the brokerage firm came into my office and proceeded to liquidate all my positions. I went from having everything on August 26th to nothing on November 17th. However, I didn't intend to give up on trading. I viewed it like blackjack in the caddy pen. I wasn't going to quit playing, but I was going to quit losing. I didn't lose that kind of money simply because of a faulty method of analysis. That may have played a role, but something else was going on to keep me in a losing position, even to the point where I went into debt to hold on to it. That something was the psychological distortion accompanying a series of successes, drawing my ego into the market position and setting me up for the disastrous loss. As mentioned in the preface, these same distortions afflicted Henry Ford and contributed to his company's downfall in the 1920s and 1930s. And these distortions continue to afflict businesses, managers, and CEOs today. For example, in 1993, management guru Peter F. Drucker wrote in the Wall Street Journal that "the past few years have seen the downfall of one once dominant business after another, General Motors, Sears, and IBM, to name just a few," and that "IBM's downfall was paradoxically caused by unique success." Drucker has also said, "Success always obsoletes the behavior that achieved it." While some of the factors contributing to these downfalls were a function of the particular strategies the firms employed, Drucker called them the five deadly business sins, there were other factors that were a function of individual managers' decision-making. This book explores the latter factors. Personalizing successes sets people up for disastrous failure. They begin to treat the success as a personal reflection rather than the result of capitalizing on a good opportunity, being at the right place at the right time, or even being just plain lucky. People begin to think their mere involvement in the undertaking guarantees success. Apparently, this is a common phenomenon. Listen to An Wang, founder of Wang Laboratories. "I find it somewhat surprising that so many talented people derail themselves one way or another during their lives. All too often, a meteoric rise triggers a precipitous fall. People fail, for the most part, because they shoot themselves in the foot. If you go for a long time without shooting yourself in the foot, other people start calling you a genius." Listen to Herb Kelleher, CEO of Southwest Airlines. "I think the easiest way to lose success is to become convinced that you are successful." This becoming convinced is the process of personalizing achievements or successes. Learning to recognize and prevent that process is what this book is all about. When I was a kid, my father told me there are two kinds of people in the world, smart people and wise people. Smart people learn from their mistakes, and wise people learn from somebody else's mistakes. Anyone reading this book has a wonderful opportunity to become wise, because I am now very, very smart. I learned a lot from the mistakes that led to $1.5 million loss in the market. But there is more to the story than the fantastic fall from the pinnacle of millionaire trader and member of the executive committee at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. There is the almost fantasy-like ascent to the top that set the stage for the collapse. One. From Hunger. I got my first job when I was 9 years old. One of my classmates was a caddy at a local country club near Ellesmere, Kentucky. One day he asked me if I wanted to be a caddy too, and I said, "Sure." My parents thought it was a good idea since it would teach me the value of a dollar. I thought it was a great idea since I would get to keep the dollars. This was the beginning of my love affair with money. As a result of working at the country club, I learned just how important money really was. It enabled people to have the nicer things in life, most of which I hadn't even known existed. My father was only making $4,000 or $5,000 a year as a surveyor back in the early 1950s, so we couldn't afford the nicer things in life. Summit Hills was not a very fancy country club, but it was a country club, and the people there had a lot more money than the people near where I lived did. So at the age of 9, I became one of the only kids in my class at St. Henry's who knew that Oldsmobiles are better. I used to caddy for Charlie Robke. He didn't play golf very well, but he made a lot of money and had a beautiful car. Charlie would show up in his new Cadillac Eldorado convertible with the top down and his good-looking blonde wife who had on a chiffon scarf sitting next to him. I would say to myself, "Self, I like what Charlie's got, and I think I want to do what Charlie's doing. I don't want to drive a Chevrolet like my folks. I'd like to have an Eldorado like Charlie." I didn't even know what Charlie did for a living, and it didn't matter. Charlie made a lot of money and had many of the nicer things in life. Goose Nichols. As far as I could see, it wasn't what you did for a living that was important in life. It was how much you got paid for doing it. This idea was driven home not only by the members of the country club like Charlie Robke, but also by the other caddies. We all admired a guy by the name of Goose. Old Goose. He was about 14 or 15, and that's old to a 9-year-old. We had a big area called the Caddy Pen where all the caddies would sit around waiting to go out on a round. We used to pitch nickels against a wall, and Goose was very good at pitching nickels. He could get those nickels to stop up against the wall almost every time. So while I was toting these big golf bags around for 4 hours to make $2, Goose was up there in the caddy pen pitching nickels. At the end of the day, Goose had more money than I did. I worked harder than Goose, but Goose had more money. He had the respect and admiration of everybody in the caddy pen, not because he could pitch nickels better than everyone else, but because he had a lot of nickels. Making money became important to me, whether I made it by slow, honest industry carrying golf bags or by quick strokes pitching nickels. It wasn't what you did. It was how much you made. No Little League. This view of the importance of money was also reinforced by my parents. They not only wanted me to learn the value of a dollar, but to have a job and start making that dollar. Some of my friends from school were trying out for the Little League baseball team, and naturally I wanted to try out too. When we got to the field, the coach asked each of us what position we wanted to try out for. I said, "Shortstop." I didn't know what a shortstop was or did, but it was the only position I'd heard my friends talk about. Besides, I was short and thought the name sounded neat. That was a mistake. Every ball hit to me either rolled between my legs, glanced off my glove, or bounced off my head. But I could hit the ball. I hit many of the pitches over the outfielders' heads. Then I hit one directly at the coach who was pitching. I made the team, playing left field. At our first game, I hit a grand slam home run to win the game 4-2. My expert fielding was responsible for the other team's 2 runs, as well as for getting my uniform dirty. Well, the uniform was a problem because I hadn't told my parents that I had gone out for tryouts and made the team. When I showed up at home that afternoon with a dirty baseball uniform for my mother to clean, I was told I had to quit. Baseball isn't practical. Caddying is. You make money caddying, not playing baseball. Thus ended my short-lived but illustrious baseball career, reinforcing my view that money was important. So it was through my exposure to the country club and the caddy pen that I first learned about money and something about making it. I also learned that it was possible to make money playing blackjack, poker, and gin. By the time I was 10, I was playing nickel blackjack. Since money was important to me, I was very upset when I almost always lost at blackjack in the caddy pen. I was whining to Goose about it one day, and he told me that I was losing because he and the other guys were cheating. He showed me how he burned the first card on the deck, placing it face up on the bottom so that you couldn't tell the difference between the top and the bottom of the deck. He would pick up the old hands and place them on the bottom, but rotate the deck as he needed the known cards on the bottom. I didn't stop playing blackjack, but I did stop losing. After being exposed to this money culture at the country club, I wanted to get involved in what the people who had the money were involved in. I wanted to know the right people. So I ingratiated myself with the right people, like Johnny Mayer. Johnny Mayer was the club champion. I became Johnny's personal caddy, which is how I got out of Ellesmere, Kentucky, the first time in my life. I went to Big Springs Country Club with Johnny in his big Chrysler convertible. He took me to Louisville to be his caddy when he played in the Kentucky State Amateur Championships. We drove from Cincinnati down to Louisville, and at 13 years old, I just thought that was the neatest thing in the world. I was in this cool car with this neat guy who was a great golfer, and I was going to a country club in another city. He was taking me because I was such a good caddy. It was only a 70-mile trip, but for me, that was a long way. My involvement with the country club set changed my perspective on the world and society. If I hadn't been involved, I never would have known about the nicer things in life. Where I grew up in Ellesmere, if you weren't exposed to this other life, you'd have never known it existed. It's the old situation where Joe Lunchbox is the happiest guy in the world. Joe Lunchbox is the guy who graduates from high school and gets a job at the local factory. He goes to work, tightens the four nuts on the left side of a V8 engine, eats his lunch, tightens the four nuts on the left side of another V8 engine, goes home, watches TV, and has a beer. He's happy because he doesn't know that Eldorados are neat, that chiffon scarves on the girl in the seat next to you are neat, and that McGregor golf clubs with the gold faces are the best, and Spalding executives are second class. You want McGregor clubs with the gold faces. If you weren't exposed to this other life, you didn't know it existed, and you didn't know you were missing it. The country club exposed me to the better things in life, and I wanted the better things. Well, that was a problem, because once I learned about this other life and that it was better, I also knew that I was missing it. I was at a disadvantage to most of my peers because I wanted more than they even knew existed. I wanted to learn how to play golf. I wanted to be one of the guys caddies would come up to and say, "Good morning, Mr. Paul," just like I had to say, "Good morning, Mr. Robke." I wanted to become one of these country club guys, not one of those Joe Lunchbox guys. Basically, what I learned at the country club was, it's not what you do for a living that's important. What's important is how much you get paid for doing it. I could work hard like Joe Lunchbox, or I could work smart like Charlie Robke. While I believed it was true that what you got paid was more important than what you did, it was also true that certain high-paying jobs required some higher education. Joe Lunchbox only went through high school, whereas the Charlie Robkes and the Johnny Myers of the world went to college. I realized that in order for me to make serious money, I was going to have to get some kind of education. In order to get a reasonable education, I was going to have to pay for it. I needed money to get an education. To make money, I had to have some money. So I always had some kind of job since I was 9 years old. I was one of the few guys in St. Henry's High paying my way through school. It was a parochial school, and I had to go because my parents were strict Catholics and they said I had to go. But my folks didn't have enough money to pay the tab, so I paid for tuition, books, and clothes. This reinforced my sense of how important money was. I caddied until I was about 15. During that time, I also worked in the pro shop and gave golf lessons. After I stopped caddying, I ran a golf driving range for a while. Next, I worked in a restaurant bussing tables, and then I worked in a service station. My senior year of high school, I worked 55 hours a week in the service station. I'd get out of school at 2 p.m. and work from 3 to 11 p.m. 5 days a week, and then 8 to 10 hours a day on Saturday and Sunday. My folks were very lenient about curfew the whole time I was growing up. I could spend my money and do whatever I wanted because I was working so hard. They really let me do whatever I wanted as long as I didn't get in trouble. My dad's attitude was, If you screw up and get in trouble, boy, I'm gonna... My parents laid the ground rules, and I followed them. Once you know what the rules are, it's easy. Just follow the rules and win. Once I figured out what it took to get from point A to point B, I did the bare minimum of what it took to get the job done. I drove my teachers crazy because I did well at what I liked, and I did poorly at what I didn't like. All you needed to pass was C's, so most of the time, I got C's. I did just what it took to get by, unless I was interested. If I liked the course, I'd get an A. Every report card I ever received had the same comment, "Does not work to potential." I really drove my teachers crazy. And to top it off, I was elected president of the student council. I was not the type of person the teachers thought should be president. They wanted one of their pet student types who didn't drink, drive fast, or otherwise screw around. I had a lot of freedom since I had my own job, my own money, and my own car. I bought a 53 Mercury on my 16th birthday with my own money, $700 cash. Man, was it neat! A year later, I sold it and bought a 56 Chevy, which was even neater. It wasn't an Eldorado, but it was neat. At 17 years old in Ellesmere, Kentucky, one of the biggest things in your life was your car. And did I ever have a car? I had the 56 Chevy lowered and shaved. I don't know if anybody will remember what shaved is, but that's when you take the emblems, the trim, and the hood ornament off the car, fill the holes with lead, and then repaint it. Then you lower it. I put a big V8 engine in it and a Hurst speed shift in the floor. This 56 Chevy was hot. It was dark metallic blue with rolled and pleated leather seats and special carpet on the floor. So by the time I was 17, I thought I was well on my way to becoming Mr. Paul at the country club. I was working and making money, and I had a cool car with a pretty girlfriend in the seat next to me. Look out, Mr. Robke. Here I come. Two. To the real world. I sold the 56 Chevy to pay for college. Neither of my parents had been to college, so it was sort of a big deal to them that I was going. I used the money from the car and my savings account to pay my way through college. The whole time I had been working, my parents had forced me to put 10% of whatever I made in a savings account that they controlled. I was accepted to the University of Kentucky in 1961. At the time, state law mandated that if you graduated from a Kentucky-accredited high school, you would be accepted to UK. The hard part was staying in once you got there. Since they didn't have room for every Kentucky high school graduate, they tried to flunk out as many students as possible in the first two semesters. The flunk-out course was freshman English. Early in my first semester, someone explained that this was the game, and I made sure they didn't flunk me out of school. I couldn't afford to fail, because the only way I was going to get into a country club as Mr. Paul was to graduate from college. So I studied my tail off and made a B in freshman English. I finished the semester with a 2.6 grade point average. All you needed to stay was a 2.0, and I made sure I stayed. Having survived that first crucial semester, I turned my attention to social life. Frat life. Boy, was I in for a surprise when I tried to make it on the social scene. Everybody around me had more money than I did. They also all had Basswegians. I didn't even know what a Basswegian was. It's a style of shoe. Everybody in Lexington wore Basswegians. I had no money, no good clothes, and no Basswegians. I didn't even have a suit. I bought my first suit when I was a senior in college, and my buddy, Tommy Crone, had to lend me the money to buy that. My folks were sending me $10 a week out of my 10% of everything bank account, and that was my spending money. When I left Ellesmere, I was a pretty big wheel. I had a neat car, I was dating the head cheerleader, I was president of the student council, and so on. I had some status as a hometown boy, but when I got down to Kentucky as a freshman, I was from hunger again. I was just another freshman in Kincaid Hall, a nobody. Socially, there is nothing more pitiful than a freshman boy in college. You are totally worthless. The freshman girls are all looking at the sophomore and junior guys, so the freshman boys just hang around with one another drinking beer and telling stories about how good it used to be in high school. After 6 months of this, I decided that if I were in a fraternity, things would pick up. So I went out for fraternity rush, which for me was a little bold since I had no good clothes, no upper-class friends, and no money. My roommate was a guy named Jim Hersha. His background was similar to mine, and since misery loves company, we went through rush together. The first rush party we went to was at the Sigma Nu house. These people were nuts. They were the Animal House chapter. I swear to God, everything in that movie could have happened at Sigma Nu. When I was a junior, the alumni built them a huge, beautiful new fraternity house. To get into the house when they had their big housewarming party, you had to throw a brick through one of the windows. Hersha and I decided that Sigma Nu's were a little too crazy, even for us. We went to a few more parties before deciding that we were going to join the Kappa Sigs. Little did we know that we weren't supposed to be the ones deciding. This is how green I was. I walked down to the hall phone in Kincaid Hall, called the Kappa Sig House, and literally asked for the president of the chapter, Herschel Robinson. Herschel got on the phone and I said, "Herschel, this is Jim Paul." Now, Herschel Robinson didn't know Jim Paul or Jim Hersha from Adam's Off Ox. "My buddy Jim Hersha and I are going through rush, and frankly, we're a little tired of going to all these parties. The Delts, the Sigma Nu's, the Sig Eps, the SAEs. We've kind of had it. We'd like to come over to the house and pick up our pledge pins." We went over to the house, and unbelievably, they gave us pledge pins. Now that I know how it is supposed to work, I can't believe we got away with that. We had the chutzpah to invite ourselves to be Kappa Sigs instead of their inviting us. We simply didn't know any better. We were breaking the rules and didn't even know it. Is gin a drink or a card game? When you join a fraternity, they make you do goofy stuff. It's a rite of passage thing. They make you shine shoes, clean windows, take out the garbage, just nickel and dime harassment stuff. One day I was at the house sitting on the floor shining shoes, and two actives, Johnny Cox and Pat Greer, were playing gin. In the middle of one of their games, Greer had to go somewhere. Johnny Cox looked over and said, "Hey, Pledge, do you know anything about gin?" "I know that if you drink as much of it as I did last night, your head hurts the next day." "No, you idiot, the card game. Do you know how to play gin?" "No, sir, I don't, but I've always wanted to learn." Now, remember, I learned how to play cards at Summit Hills Country Club when I was 10 years old. I'd been playing gin for 8 years. "Well, stop that shoe-shining shit and come over here." So I went over to the table, and he said, "All right, we're going to play gin. And understand, Pledge, that you play gin for money." "Yes, sir, I understand that, but I don't have any money. I mean, I really don't have any money." The truth of the matter was, I didn't have any money, but I also wasn't that worried that I didn't have any money. Cox said, "I understand that. I understand. We'll make it very, very cheap. You still have to play for money, but we won't play for any real money. We'll only play for 5 cents a point." If you don't know anything about playing gin, you wouldn't know that 5 cents a point is real money. A nickel a point, a dollar a box, $5 a game means you're probably playing somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 to $15 a game. That isn't cheap. A game to 150 points might take 10 hands, 15 hands tops. Somebody's going to get to 150 about every 20 or 30 minutes. So now you're playing at a rate of about $30 an hour. Now that is real money. Cox explained the rules and told me how the score is kept and so on. Then he dealt out the cards. I would gin and I'd ask, "I'm sorry, sir, I've forgotten. What do I do again when I don't have a discard? When they all match?" And he'd go crazy. "Just lay 'em down, Pledge." "Okay, okay, you win." He really didn't think I knew a thing about what was going on. We played for 17 hours before he said, "That's it, I quit." I won $612, which in 1962 was a whole lot of money. Tuition was $81 a semester, so $612 was big money. He didn't have $612, but he gave me $50 and owed me the rest. For the remainder of my pledge year, I didn't have to shine any more shoes, clean garbage cans, or anything. He'd get other pledges to shine the shoes, and then I would credit him 25 cents a pair. Whenever the other actives wanted me to do something, I'd say, "Fine, write it down. Johnny, I'm supposed to clean the garbage cans. What do you think that's worth? $2? "Okay, fine, subtract $2. Somebody else would have to do the garbage cans, and I'd sit in there and play gin with Cox. That was another lesson in working smart instead of working hard. Not having to do any more grunt work as a pledge sort of set me apart from the other pledges. I was also beginning to think of myself as a little different from most people. I succeeded at just about anything I did. I had followed the rules of the game in freshman English and succeeded. Then I had unknowingly broken the rules for entering a fraternity, but still succeeded. I was a little different. Very little class. I was beginning to think of myself as a little better than other people. I had a whole semester when I didn't even buy a book and rarely went to class. I'd get up around 10 a.m. and go to the grill in the student union building. That's where everybody went between classes. I'd sit and socialize, play hearts, another card game, talk to the women, make dates, and read the Kentucky Colonel, the school newspaper. We not only met girls and made dates at the grill, some of us met our wives to be there. I broke the rules and still succeeded in that arena, too. When I met Pat, I was dating two other girls, Sandra and Debbie, on a regular basis. I had just finished reading Tortilla Flat by John Steinbeck. The main character in the book is a guy named Danny. He and his friends are poor and lived up in the hills outside of Monterey, California. One of the themes of the book is that people can rationalize anything. For example, when a friend comes into some money, Danny steals it and rationalizes that he's actually doing the friend a favor by stealing it. "If I don't take the money away from my friend, he is going to use it to buy some wine, get drunk, and maybe even burn his house down. It's just awful that he has this money. To be his friend, I need to steal the money from him and save him from himself." I liked this book so much that I bought 3 more copies and gave 1 to Pat, 1 to Sandra, and 1 to Debbie. That was a mistake. A big mistake. Even though they were in different sororities, they used to meet in the grill with a few other girls and have lunch. And one fateful day, all 3 girls were sitting there with the same damn book.
"Gee, it's interesting you're reading that book."
"Yeah, the guy I'm going with gave it to me."
"Oh, really? Me too. Me too. Who might this be?"
Little did I know that when it came to dealing with women, you shouldn't use the same modus operandi if you are going to go out with more than one of them at the same time. Why? Because women talk to one another, and if they find out you're treating each of them the same way, none will feel special and all of them will dump you. Luckily for me, Pat didn't dump me. I just had this knack for doing things the wrong way but still succeeding. My first fraternity roommate was a guy by the name of Jim Dillon. He skipped a lot of classes too, but he flunked out. Almost anybody who ran around with me flunked out. Hersha flunked out, Dylan flunked out, Durkin flunked out, a lot of people flunked out. But I didn't flunk out. This just reinforced my view that I was a little different and somehow a little better than everyone else. A few other guys tried to live with Dylan and me, but nobody could handle it. The reason they couldn't live with us is that we didn't do what students are supposed to do. Go to school. We'd stay up all night, drink beer, and talk. After we took our dates home, we'd get back to the room around 11 p.m., and then we'd sit and talk and drink beer until early in the morning. Well, you can't really stay up until 3 a.m. and make an 8 a.m. class. So we didn't go to class very often. Teachers don't like it when you don't go to class. And if you don't ever go, sooner or later, you're going to have a problem. The first semester I lived in the fraternity house, I ended up making every grade Kentucky had. A, B, C, D, E. E was an F at Kentucky. W, withdraw. And I, incomplete. I got them all. Even though I rarely went to economics class, I made an A in the course. I understood it. The professor would talk about marginal propensity to consume, and I'd say to myself, I get it. That's a concept I can understand. I could look at those supply and demand curves and say, yeah, okay, I understand that. That makes sense. Okay, we're going to move supply here. Yep, price will go down. Yep, I understand. I didn't even own an economics book. I literally borrowed a book the night before the economics final, sat down and read the whole book for the first time. I went in and made an A because I understood it. I can remember taking the test thinking, okay, that question, he's talking about marginal. I can see it. Okay, the chart looks like this. It's on the left side of the page. It should be somewhere around page 250. And what does it say? I could remember exactly where it was, what it looked like, and what it said. And then I just wrote it down. I'm not claiming to have a photographic memory, but for that class, I did. The professor hated it because I rarely went to class, and I always made A's on his tests. It really ticked him off. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing, but I still did well in school. I made the B in history and the C, D, and E in I can't remember what, and I made the W in philosophy. W is withdraw from the class with no grade, and it's beautiful because you don't get a bad grade. It's like you didn't even sign up for the course. God only knows why I signed up for philosophy. I hated it. It made no sense to me at all. It was all left-field stuff. I think, therefore I am. Who cares? It was like baseball to me. Not very practical. So I had no problem withdrawing from philosophy. A glimpse of the future. Zzz. My incomplete course that semester was statistics. Although I liked the professor, Dr. Christian, I didn't like statistics. It was too hard. One day, Doc Christian called me and said, "There's a friend of mine over here that you need to meet. I think you'd like what he does for a living. You're suited for this game." The old friend was Horace Jack Salmon, a UK graduate and the sales manager of a regional commodity futures specialty brokerage firm in Louisville, Kentucky. I didn't expect to know what he was talking about. I didn't know futures from past participles, but I respected Dr. Christian and thought, who knows, maybe I'll like what Jack Salmon does for a living. So I went over to Christian's office to meet Salmon. Jack sat there and talked about soybean prices going up and going down, weather, Japan, acreage, yields, the excitement of the markets, and how you either make a lot of money or you lose a lot. The money thing got my attention. You can make money doing this? You can make a lot of money. Oops! That's what I wanted to do. Make a lot of money. When people asked me what I was going to do when I got out of school, my answer was, make a lot of money. Well, what are you going to do? I'm going to be in business. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I never thought about what I was going to do. It wasn't what you did for a living. It was how much you got paid for it. out of school. I finally graduated in August 1965. Yes, August. I had to go to summer school to pass second semester freshman accounting. I hated accounting. Accounting to me was find the missing nickel bullshit. My attitude was, I don't care where the nickel is. Pay someone to find it.